Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Avi Stamen, host of Scholarly Communication. When I'm not podcasting, I dedicate time to my family, mountain biking, and running my company, Academic Language Experts. At Academic Language Experts, we help academic scholars, researchers, and science professionals with translation, editing, writing, and publication support for their research. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Jason Prevost from Brill. Jason is the liaison for publication ethics, the coordinating chair of the Publication Ethics Committee, and a senior acquisitions editor responsible for social sciences and international relations portfolio at Brill. Jason's been at Brill since 2014 and is based out of the Boston office. It's really great timing that we're speaking today as my company, Academic Language Experts, and Brill are this week commencing on a partnership to empower authors in the humanities and social sciences to publish their research with confidence. Jason, thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy day to chat with me.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Of course. So I was hoping you can kind of take us back a little bit and maybe tell us about two career milestones. And first would be, you know, kind of how you got into academic publishing in general. What drew you to it? Was that always your dream from when you were a little kid, or kind of did you fall into that? And then specifically, once you were in the world of academic publishing, how in the world did you get stuck with the ethics portfolio, and how did that come about?
Indeed. Many moons ago, you know, having finished graduate school at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and having, you know, grown up for the most part in New England, and always having been a devotee of the written word, it made sense to move back home, especially to such a hub of an active hub of the publishing industry, Boston. And so I started off freelancing, you know, copy editing, providing some translation services, really from the ground up, real red pen type stuff, learning the actual nuts and bolts of publishing, really from the ground up. And then that segued into a more professional capacity in textbook publishing, actually, with Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and then Pearson. And then I moved I spent some time actually doing content marketing, the editorial side. And then I moved to the American Meteorological Society, which was my first position in academic publishing. And there I was responsible with a few other colleagues for coordinating the peer review process for the AMS's journals. And so that was the beginning of my career in academic publishing. And then when it comes to ethics, so even at AMS, there was clear immersion in the publication ethics side of things, stewarding the peer review, of course. Starting to work at Brill in 2014, I started with Brill to spearhead a publication initiative, a new publication type called Brill Research Perspectives. Having succeeded in launching that at Brill across our various subject areas, I was then tasked with assuming responsibility for the social sciences and American studies as a priority growth area. In my roles at Brill, there's been a clear element of, you know, launching initiatives, spearheading various undertakings. And so, and even in the growth area of social sciences, where we've really captured some great visibility and improved our profile in the publishing landscape. So all of that, I think those were considerations that factored into our CPO, Yasmin Lange, reaching out to me in early 2019 to overhaul our publication ethics from scratch. At that time, we had a very, very limited statement, just a Word document providing very rudimentary guidance. And so we needed something with greater depth, a more refined and clear and transparent policy and procedure for publication ethics cases. So I think that those considerations factored in. So I took that on. And one of the first, and it was in response actually to a spate of problems that came to light, publication ethics violations in late 2018, and really threw into relief how, you know, how urgent it was that we improve our policy and procedure. And so, you know, it's been a remarkable journey, publication ethics at Brill, in the sense of the knowledge and experience I've gained and we've collectively gained, and how successfully we've established our policy and streamlined procedure for retractions and core agenda and errata and such. And that that journey started with my attendance at Koch's North American Seminar in Philadelphia in May 2019, where I also had the pleasure to meet Michael Dougherty of Ohio Dominican University, professor of philosophy, who also happens to now be a member of our Publication Ethics Committee. And so, yeah, so we founded the committee, 21 members, 13 Brill staff, including the CPO, Yasmin Lange, publishing unit directors representing all of the publishing units, and acquisitions editors from a variety of subject areas, as well as 8 external academics of varying degrees of seniority, mostly mid to late career. So that's...
Yeah, wow. That's fascinating. I don't know what you're, you know, how much you're allowed to say, but can you give us a specific instance, either that in Brill or outside of Brill, that you felt like maybe is a good example so people can get a real idea and understanding of like, what are we talking about when we're talking about ethical violations? Are these, you know, are these paper mill papers? Are these people who are, you know, stealing from other researchers? What exactly are we alluding to here?
Right. Well, publication ethics violations, there's a whole taxonomy, numerous flavors, so to speak. You know, what I see most of is plagiarism or self-plagiarism, which I can explain often, well, not often, sometimes of a serious serial nature. We've seen quite a bit of that. We're seeing less and less, though, and I think it's partly owing to our improved policy and procedure, but also problems related to provenance of artifacts, for example, omissions or inaccuracies about the provenance, sometimes willful distortions. We've also dealt with segmented or also known as salami publication, cutting up, you know, one study or data set from a single study into various publications and, you know, misrepresenting that as if it were coming from numerous studies, as well as dealing with fabrications and falsifications. So in breaches of care, duty of care, for example, so violations of how research subjects, human or animal, were dealt with, and all manner of violations, really. So it's a complex environment.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of like moving parts and you have to kind of keep track of. I'm curious, you know, this might be a difficult question to answer, but, you know, what do you find that most of the issues that you're dealing with are actually what you would call, you know, some sort of fraud where the author is aware? Or do you think it's more a general sort of ignorance about what is and is not acceptable behavior and practice in academic research, and it's more of an educational, and I assume that the reaction or the response to that needs to be a little bit different than if you think someone is simply, you know, trying to pull the wool over your eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've had both. We've had instances of innocent omissions, failure to cite, maybe in the pressure to publish and strict deadlines and just the the fast pace of the publication process, there have been some instances where something was caught by peer reviewers, and that's a little different. If something is caught and it appears innocent enough, then we allow the author pre-publication to correct it. Of course, if it doesn't have any appearance of willful violation, but we've also, and these do happen, or even post-publication, where an author contacts us and voluntarily and says, "Oh my gosh, I noticed I failed to cite in these two instances. Can I please correct it?" And of course, we're accommodating, and we don't think the worst in those situations. But we have also had numerous scenarios of willful, unsighted, unattributed borrowing, sometimes of a serial nature across numerous publications at Brill and other publishers.
Can I just stop you? You use the term willful borrowing. What's the exact term?
Well, unattributed borrowing or
unattributed borrowing. Is that a nice way to say plagiarism? I just want to make sure that our audience understands what we're aiming at here.
It is.
Okay, got it. All right, continue. My apologies.
That's a sanitized. Plagiarism is a very ugly word.
Indeed. Yeah. Got it. Okay.
So, we've even had a case where the serial plagiarism, and by that I mean numerous publications, a clear pattern of repeated research misbehavior, was accompanied by a misrepresentation of qualifications and experience. So not only the serial plagiarism, but also attaching to that a false bio, misrepresenting affiliations, institutional affiliations. So it really, sometimes there are some really grievous scenarios.
Is that part of your responsibility as a publisher, you think, to start digging into the background and making sure the person is who they say they are or has the credentials? Because I feel like, that can be hard. You're not necessarily going to hire a private investigator or do a background search on each and every author. But on the other hand, you obviously want people who are who they say they are.
Sure. On a day-to-day basis for our acquisitions editors and desk editing staff and our publishing partners, whether it's book series editors or journal editors or board members, I don't think it's sustainable to conduct an investigation for each and every author. So there's an element of trust. And there's also, I think, a valid and healthy assumption that the academic community is self-regulating to a certain degree, and most importantly, peer review factors into that. And the peer review process is indispensable, central to identifying those types of misbehaviors.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, you mentioned before the salami research where you're, and that, I find that really interesting. I'm curious, in my line of work, what I've come across a number of times is especially, I would say, sort of more junior scholars who have spent a lot of time and effort into their doctorate. And then they kind of take their doctorate and mix it up a little bit and try and publish it in a few different ways. And on the one hand, let's say it's a doctorate of 250 pages and then they turn it into four or five articles. On the one hand, that makes a lot of sense, right? There's enough material there. On the other hand, I think there are times where it's a bit forced. It feels a bit forced and maybe they're trying to squeeze, a few publications and kind of just saying the same things in different ways than they've already said previously. So are there, clear guidelines in terms of, how can a scholar take their doctorate and then republish it in other forms? And if so, kind of what are the borders of that, republication and what's appropriate?
That's a very good question. So in principle, chopping up a doctorate, a dissertation or a thesis into multiple publications or even revising it to be a monograph, which is also an option, is perfectly acceptable. But there are some gray areas that you allude to. So, for example, getting a number of different articles out of one dissertation, perfectly acceptable. However, two factors. Some journals may shy away from that, the publication of material from a doctoral work. But that's rare. Most journals are accepting of it, provided the material is sufficiently revised. And by that, the published product differs substantially from the doctoral work, from the dissertation, because it has to be revised for a much broader readership, academic readership, or even general. You're not writing for a PhD committee, of course. Taking out the methodology section, removing much of the literature review, which is not necessary, alluding to some of that maybe in an introduction. But, really, a dissertation, the author is demonstrating his or her authority and trying to validate it, whereas in a monograph or a published article, that authority is assumed. And so the references are to enrich the reader's experience and also to provide adequate citation. So it's a very different product. But back to the question of dividing it up, no problem at all. Most institutions publish these dissertations in an internal repository. Some are online visibly. Also not a problem, provided the citation is made to the dissertation, to the doctoral work. So the citation is paramount, whether it's in a monograph or a published article. And also that gray area. And then now we move into the direction of self-plagiarism and segmented or salami publication. And I could see, especially with the pressure to publish, that some junior scholars especially could succumb to the temptation of getting even more out of the dissertation than is appropriate with some overlap. So there are three varieties of self-plagiarism, really. There's the simple recycling of pre-published work. There's duplicate, or aka multiple or redundant publications, sending the same article out to numerous publications at once. And then there's the segmented publication, which gives the false appearance of numerous studies. So anytime, especially a junior scholar wishes to revise a dissertation into a monograph or to divide it up into several published articles, I would strongly recommend seeking the counsel of senior colleagues, senior scholars, about the best and most ethical way to approach that and to avoid any temptation to really over-profit from that.
Right. Yeah, and it sounds, what's interesting about what you're saying is that it sounds like not only is, do you avoid the issues with ethics that way, it's also best practice in terms of thinking critically about your target audience. Because if you actually, are thinking about who's going to be reading this, so you have to ask yourself the question, well, is it justified more than what I've already put out? And if it really is a different audience and you really have different points to make, so actually go ahead and do that. Whereas if you're just kind of trying to recycle it in a new, and get the same thing published in different words, then maybe that's an issue. I know that we've got, we at times get requests as an author services editing company to just rewrite certain sections that were flagged in the plagiarism check, and oftentimes they say, but this is my words, it's all plagiarism. I have, a sort of a little bit of sympathy because when it's your own work, I think it's really important to understand that the whole point of research is to produce novel ideas and concepts. And even if you're regurgitating yourself, you're kind of going against that idea.
That's right. And of course any author who self, plagiarizes like that without attribution to where it was originally published does a disservice to themselves, because actually there's a benefit to be drawn from directing attention to the previously published work and then demonstrating that some novel ideas, some additional original material is being built upon previous observations. So I think that self citation, it's critical for the integrity of the scholarly record, but it's also a service to oneself as well as to the broader community.
So. Got it. Now, I want to talk about original authorship for a minute. Can you talk to us? I think it goes without saying for most of our listeners that, we're going to be the authors of our own papers. But even that is not necessarily, fully across the board. I know that, there's a whole industry of science writers who help scientists with, writing their papers. I think, we come across a decent number of, doctors who are, maybe surgeons in hospitals that they've got all this great data and they want to get it out there. And they're just like, they A, don't have time, and B, don't have, the they just don't have the training maybe to write a formal paper. So do you think that there are, is it sort of across the board that you know, having a ghostwriter or someone else write for you or with you is problematic? And are there cases where that's okay? And do you see a difference maybe between the humanities and social sciences in this context, or between, I guess, humanities, social sciences on the one hand, and maybe some of the STEM or medical fields on the other?
Well, being fully immersed in the humanities and social sciences as I am, we don't see much of that activity. I myself, in my experience, haven't ever seen it. I'm not too well equipped. That I know of, indeed, which is an unsettling thought. But I'm not too well acquainted with that industry, if we'll call it that, on the STEM side. But what I can say is that, strictly speaking, that type of ghostwriting is a misrepresentation of authorship. And there are a few varieties of that. So you have ghostwriting where it's contributing in part or in whole with the expectation of not being credited, and especially, you know, often induced, or there's a financial inducement just as a service. There is, and that kind of dovetails with marketplace authorship, buying or selling authorship of academic manuscripts. And then there's honorary authorship, right? So naming senior or influential members of, say, one's department who, you know, who may have helped secure funding. So there's a certain cronyism there. There's gift authorship. So naming a senior or even a junior colleague as an author with the understanding, explicit or implicit, that the other party will do the same. So a bit of a quid pro quo. There is, coercive authorship, which happily we're seeing much less of as we move forward. But, you know, senior researcher imposing upon, a junior researcher to do the work, and things like that. So strictly speaking, this type of activity is a publication ethics violation. It's a misrepresentation of authorship.
Have you actually come across any of these scenarios in your work on the ethics committee? It sounds to me like these things do happen. I mean, there's no doubt about that, but, you know, uncovering them is probably quite challenging and difficult. You know, how do you really know if the senior academic was involved and to what extent they're involved? I mean, you're not putting video cameras in their faculty lounge. So, you know, have you come across situations where you've had to deal with these issues?
This type of violation is the most elusive, of course, because I think it happens far more frequently than we'd like to think, just in the normal workplace, or not normal, but, you know, the certain workplace dynamics, right, that we're not aware of. I have had some experience with one case similar to this, but it involved a PhD candidate who wrote substantial portions of a couple of chapters, like 50% of each, and was not credited in the published work. And this was actually a very long process to resolve it, because there was pushback from the senior researchers who were involved, and there was pushback from a series editor, and it was almost political in some respects. But we did stand fast by our principles and our policies, and we did prevail in the end on everyone involved to correct the record and to put a notice clearly giving credit to the PhD candidate for the work that was done. So that is one case. Yeah.
And that's probably part of your, you know, I imagine you have a lot of parts of this job which can be quite frustrating at times, but I guess, you know, those little wins probably make it all worth it, that, you know, you've kind of done justice to the author. And I think that's really amazing and important. I'm sort of, as I'm hearing you speak, it's really fascinating. Aside from the fact that I'm just, you know, fascinated by ethics dilemmas and questions in general, I imagine that, you know, you've got this quite a large team. It sounds like 21 people on the committee. But are you sitting there sort of hashing out, you know, having these philosophical debates and hashing out policy? Or are there like More general, resources or sources of authority that you refer to or go to. You mentioned COPE. Maybe you could talk about kind of how you go about even, once you have those guidelines in place, I guess, you have to just apply them, which even then can be, not always so simple, but how do you go about creating the guidelines in the first place? Or how do you go about, altering them or dealing with new situations and dynamics? I'm sure, open access has probably, led to certain questions that never came up before. So how do you even come up with policy for that?
Well, so in the formative stages, COPE was and continues to be our principal resource. Founded in 1997, COPE was currently chaired by Daniel Culpe, Senior Director, Editorial Development Journals at the American Chemical Society. So it's a longstanding 25-year anniversary now for COPE. They have an abundance of resources, even workflows, for various types of violation scenarios and retractions and recommended best practices. And they're just a valuable resource for the entire publishing community, whether it be editors or publishers or institutes, research centers. And so as we formulated the policy, I did a lot of research. As I mentioned, I attended the North American seminar in 2019. I scoured their editorial workflows, and I tried to distill both for my taxonomy of violations as they're listed in the publication ethics document, as well as our basic protocol for handling any alleged violation, I'll say. So they were my starting point. And so as we went through I worked very closely with Yasmin Longer, a CPO, and once that was in place, then, we set up the committee, and we've also, over the years, established a clear procedure on the operations side to ensure. So I work closely with my colleague, data manager Marion Yekel, who joined us on the committee to ensure that, once we've deliberated and come to a clear decision, consensus on any type of allegation of violation, then it's the follow through that really matters most. Because, if retractions are agreed on, but if they're poorly processed, if they're posted in such a way that's non-standard or partial or things like that, or if they fall through the cracks or if the metadata is not updated. So a lot of those steps are just as important as the deliberation, if not more so, of course, for the downstream literature. So the way we get to that, when a case comes up, give you a simple overview. The process is that an acquisitions editor or a publishing director from one of the units will bring it to my attention. We'll discuss it, various aspects. There are some cases that are so of such a serious nature that we do involve Yasmin in the conversation. Typically, and sometimes by email, we'll reach out to one or more, typically three committee members for their input, depending on their area of expertise or their prior experience. And then we come to a decision and we move forward. We inform the stakeholders, editors, authors, whoever it may be. Now, on the other hand, the Publication Ethics Committee has two meetings per year that I coordinate. So we have our mid-year meeting, and then we have our annual, year in review meeting. And so at the mid-year meeting and throughout every calendar year, as the year goes along, I compile an archive of case studies for each year. And so at these meetings, the general setup is that, I'll provide an overview of developments at Brill. What are we doing now? For example, we're exploring Crossmark right now and doing some other things in the CoREC initiative with NISO about the preserving the scholarly record. Like, how do you get retractions? How do you make people aware that they're potentially citing retracted material? How do you educate authors to flag that when they do? So various things we're looking into, far more refined than what we were doing a few years ago. But in these meetings, I provide an update on developments within Brill. I highlight some emerging or persistent trends that we discuss more broadly, and then I present an overview of active case studies, some of which do require more vigorous discussion. And we do that at both meetings, but then at the end of the year, I submit my annual report on publication ethics that goes deeper into some of these explorations and prevents a fuller acquisition.
Really interesting. Yeah. So it's interesting you mentioned the issue of retractions. I interviewed Ivan Aransky recently from Retraction Watch. And what surprised me, one of the things he said, which really surprised me and kind of made me think, was he wasn't as bothered by, or, you know, I don't want to speak in his name, but my impression was that he wasn't necessarily as bothered by the fact that sometimes fraud gets through, because there will always be, in such a big industry, people who try to cut corners. What bothered him more is the delay of the publishers in retracting and dealing with those issues that came up. Sometimes he said they would ignore it entirely. Sometimes it would take time for them to retract that. So is that something that you, you know, have seen with other publishers? You know, I'm sure you do your best to make sure that Brill, but maybe I guess the way I want to frame the question is, maybe you could share with us some of the challenges on your end when you do identify something. You know, how do you actually handle and cope with that so that it is done in a timely way, but also, you know, that maybe the author is gets their chance to you know, give their side and try and work something out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you make a very important observation, and that's one of the most important functions of COPE, really, is to help the publishing industry community achieve a certain degree of consistency in how they handle these things. And there's it's pretty wildly variable across publishers. Some, and I did in one of my reports, I actually did an overview. Of course, I'm not going to name names, but from small to mid-sized to large publishers, the differences, and even publicly posted publication ethics policy, whether that was even available across different publishers. So a lot of variation, inconsistency, and COPE, I know, strenuously continues to work toward improving that, you know, by getting the word out. But to answer your question, so when we're presented with an allegation of an ethics violation, it's first and foremost, we want to hear from all sides and ensure that it's a balanced assessment. And I recently actually had a situation where it was brought to my attention that another publisher's author notified that publisher of similarities with that person's work in our published work. However, so we took a look. The publishing director, another acquisitions editor, and myself took a close look, a comparative. We did a line-by-line comparison of the documents, publications in question. And what emerged, though, was that the similarity of language was due to the use of concepts, really. So it was just the concepts, the jargon specific to that field. And so the expression linguistic innovation, okay? So sometimes when citing, for example, case law, legal concepts, for example, there's no way to change the language without unnecessary and linguistic variation that could potentially deteriorate, you know, diminish the quality of the work. And linguistic innovation is actually looked upon disapprovingly in the academic community. If you have to say something a certain way and it's standard phraseology, then it's best to do so. And that does not constitute unattributed borrowing or plagiarism. And so anyway, in this case, we did a very, very close inspection of the materials in question. And we also consulted the author as well as the editor of the publication, and you know, gave them, you know, an audience, and it was compellingly demonstrated and argued that there was no malicious plagiarism or other type of, you know, questionable borrowing. It was just the fact that the language was necessary as written, and it was unavoidable. But that's a situation where we made a point of speaking with the author in question, who's, you know, being accused, working with the editor, getting that person's views, and building a case and a response to the other publisher. So it's never knee-jerk. We do take into consideration everyone's viewpoints and ensure that we have a balanced solution. Yeah.
Got it. That makes sense. All right. I wanna bring ourselves to the end, but there's one question that I have to ask you because it's so intriguing to me. And I didn't know before we got on here that you're a translator. So you're going to have to tell me what languages you used to translate. But I'm curious because I've come across this a few times. I've been asked about this. What do you say about translated works? Are they kind of duplicate publications, or is there no translation without, you know, some sort of interpretation, and therefore they become new works? Curious what you have to hear about that, but I do want to know what languages you translate, because that in fascinating.
Yeah, well, most of the work I did, translation work, was French. That's the focus, but I also did some. So my background is in, well, at the grad level is in classical studies, so a bit of the of Latin and ancient Greek, mostly French though. So translations, and you know, reused materials as well, but it touches on that. But and I know that you and I discussed reused materials as well. But so for translations, you have two scenarios. You have the licensing, you know, and there's the ethics of that, the licensing, the appropriate copyright notice, any credits and acknowledgements, and, you know, making sure that the whole process is above board. But there is something called translation plagiarism that one needs to keep an eye out for. Now, a translation is a translation. There's nothing ethically questionable about it if handled in a standard above board fashion. But translation plagiarism is a real problem, and it happens quite frequently. Where the violator assumes that no one will catch on to it because it's coming from a language not as widely read, especially if it's not, say, a continental European language or something. You know, there's this assumption that the risk of being caught is minimal. And so what they'll do is they'll present it as their own work, but it'll be often verbatim translation from the original, or sometimes even worse, actually, and much more difficult to detect, is they'll paraphrase the translated material, which then adds a layer of concealment, right? But yeah, that's that. And then, but reuse doesn't really apply to translation work, although. I don't know if you wanted me to comment on that, the reuse of material, since we touched
on that. Well, yeah, I was kind of curious, because that happens with us sometimes, where authors will come to us and say, listen, I've published something in German, and I got a publication out of it in German. Can I come now and translate it into English and, you know, have it count as an independent publication?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's completely acceptable, provided, you know, the proper licensing, well, permissions are granted. And unless the author has retained the English rights, for example, then there's no hindrance to that. And republishing an article, say, as a chapter in a book, again, if it's a translation, standard process. If it's the same material from a previous, say, an article being published in a collected volume, verbatim republication, provided the permissions are there and the citation, the attribution, you know, of the original publication is made. That's more an editorial matter of editorial discretion, whether they want previously published material. If it's going to be built into a broader work, like how much of a book can be previously published work, there's no hard calculus on that. Again, very much an editorial matter. You know, what new value does this publication bring? And also an author, it's in the author's best interest not to just rehash previously published material, of course, always to build on with new insights. So.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful, because I think that, you know, my advice to authors is always, if you're straightforward with all the parties involved and tell them, then you won't run into issues. You know, if you tell the place you published in, you tell the place that you're planning on publishing in, and everything is sort of on the table. What the problem is when you started trying to pass things off as if they're, you know, entirely original, when they may, you know, have already been written and published in another language. So I just want to, you know, kind of summarize and you know, conclude and ask you, you know, I could tell, you know, in speaking to you before and speaking to you throughout this interview, that, you know, I don't know, this may have been kind of put on your plate you know, whether you asked for it or not, but it sounds like you're really kind of taking a liking to it and really made it your own. So I'm kind of curious, what is it about this area of work that, you know, appeals to you or that speaks to you and that really gets you kind of going and interested in it?
Well, there is the intellectual curiosity, of course. It's a fascinating field, ethics generally, and then publication ethics, of course, has an application to my, you know, my vocation. So the intellectual, it's intellectually stimulating. And just the sheer variety of the cases we're confronted with, you know, and also, but the good that we can do as publishers by engaging energetically with publication ethics. You know, there have been cases, we didn't touch on this, but very quickly, there's, I think I alluded to it, a type of violation called breaches of duty of care. You know, and so let's say, you know, you're human research subjects, are you dealing with the elderly or with children, vulnerable populations, things like that. So whether, you know, when you think of whether it's from censorship or self-censorship, which is also a violation, or you have people plagiarizing authors or vulnerable populations not being worked with in an appropriate manner, according to like institutional review boards, things like that. So It's edifying, it's intellectually stimulating, but it's also more importantly, personally and professionally edifying to perform this service for the academic community. So in one in which I and my colleagues take great pride, because often our partners are confronted with very complex situations. Some are very simple and above board, straightforward, easily resolved. Some are very complex and sometimes sensitive, even sometimes receiving a fair amount of publicity. You know, especially with unprovenanced artifacts, there have been a lot of cases that have hit the news about that. So helping them navigate those and coming to the best, most equitable conclusion, and much in the spirit of COPE and aligning ourselves with their core principles and best practices, you know, we try to mirror their mission in our everyday dealings. And so, you know, that's it. Like I said, it's rewarding to know that we're doing our part to ensure the integrity of the scholarly record and to correct it, to preserve it, and thereby to provide a superior service to our publishing partners, you know, and to allow them to publish with us in such a way that they're confident and able to focus on producing quality scholarship.
Brilliant. Jason, it's been a pleasure speaking with you and learning from you about this area, which I have to admit, I, you know, you hear bits and pieces here and there, but I'm not sure that I was aware that there was someone who was, you know, given as much thought in sort of a comprehensive and whole and encompassing way to these issues, which really, you know, are kind of, I think they're, maybe we take them for granted, but they actually serve as the basis in our belief in research. And I think without that, you know, kind of all of science and the way that the world functions is, you know, is put into question. And you know, we saw this over the pandemic, that there were, you know, the debate over the veracity of science was not something that, you know, kind of was decided as I would have expected, but actually is very much alive and well. And I think that the gatekeepers who make sure that the science is real science are the ones that we can kind of rely on and say, no, you know, There's a method to the madness, and there are people who are making sure that, you know, that nothing wrong gets in. So kudos to you, and thanks to you for all your hard work in that regard. And thank you for taking the time to share and just, you know, inform, you know, me and our listeners about, you know, this really fascinating area.
My pleasure. I've greatly enjoyed it. And for your listeners, if ever there's a question of publication ethics, if they have questions, if they have identified a potential violation, they can always reach out to us at publicationethics@brill.com. And that is a mailbox that I routinely monitor. And we're always happy to provide guidance or, you know, otherwise work with our partners.
Brilliant. And do you have any, you know, I don't know if you're on any socials, but are you on LinkedIn that people can reach out?
Indeed. You can find me on LinkedIn, Jason Prevost. Yep.
Brilliant. Fantastic. All right. Thanks, Jason. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Avi. You have a great afternoon.
You too.